You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is Paul Franklin, an independent scholar and a leading expert on Marcel Duchamp based in Paris and Serret. From 2000 to 2016, Paul was the editor-in-chief of the annual bilingual scholarly journal Etant Donné Marcel Duchamp, one of the most highly regarded publications devoted to the artist and his work. He also worked with Duchamp's heirs for many years, managing the artist's estate. Paul earned his doctorate in art history from Harvard University and has subsequently lectured and published widely on Duchamp. Among recent publications are The Artist and His Critics Stripped Bare, The Correspondence of Marcel Duchamp and Robert Lebel, published by the Getty Research Institute in 2016, and Can One Make Works That Are Not Works of Art? Marcel Duchamp's Bottle Rack in Marcel Duchamp, Porte Bouteille, published by Galerie Thaddeus Ropack in 2016. In 2018, he curated the exhibition Brancusi and Duchamp, The Art of Dialogue at the Kasman Gallery in New York, for which he also wrote the catalog. In 2020, he curated Matisse in Black and White, also at Kasman. Franklin's exhibition Please Touch, Marcel Duchamp and the Fetish, opened at the Galerie Thaddeus Ropack in London in 2021 and traveled to Paris in 2022. His most recent curatorial project, Marcel Duchamp and the Lure of the Copy, will open in October 2023 at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice. I might add that Paul Franklin's Duchamp and Cage volume, number 6 in the Etant Donné Marcel Duchamp series, is among my very favorite Cage publications. Working together for the John Cage Trust to provide appropriate materials from within its own archives for this volume was, in fact, the very thing that first brought us together back in 2003. Stay tuned at the end of this week's program to hear Margaret Lang Tan play John Cage's Music for Marcel Duchamp from 1947, heard here courtesy of Mode Records, Mode 106, John Cage Volume 25 from 2002. Enjoy. Welcome to All Things Cage, Paul. It's such a pleasure to see you.
It's such a pleasure to see you, Laura, and to be back in touch.
It's amazing to think about how long it's been since I've seen you, but then also amazing to think how long I've known you. And so as Paul and I were talking for our audience, we were talking this morning a little bit about how this might just be one of those shows where it's most appropriate to spend our time getting to know each other again. And along the way, learning the ins and outs of our relationship and the people that we've loved and who have been with us that have crossed both of our lives.
Absolutely.
If potentially. So, Paul, I think that you and I got together initially, you remind me, was it through Monique Fong?
I think it was. It was through two avenues, through Monique Fong, who is a close friend of mine, and yours, and who was a close friend of Marcel Duchamp's as well. And it was also through Jackie Matisse Monnier, who was Duchamp's stepdaughter, and with whom I worked for many, many years, and who supported me when I was editing my Duchamp journal out of Paris from 2000 to 2016. And Jackie actually had the idea that we devote a special issue of my Duchamp journal to John Cage.
This Duchamp journal that Paul is talking about is called Etant Donné, which is, correct, of course, the name also of a work by Duchamp. But that journal is marvelous, every single issue of it. But speaking just to the Cage issue, mm-hmm, it's one of my favorite books, truly one of my favorite books in the John Cage literature.
So, thank you, Laura.
Yeah, it's a great, great book.
It was an incredible privilege and pleasure to produce that volume, because it opened so many doors for me to John Cage, to Merce Cunningham, to Jasper Johns, to Robert Rauschenberg, and this whole world that sprang up around Duchamp after the Second World War. And it led to my meeting with Monique Fung and my meeting with you. And it sort of had this afterlife that continues to be so rich and so pleasurable for me as a person and as a scholar.
I can imagine. I can only imagine, because that book is so, you also called on, I don't know who helped you. I may have helped you a bit. You may have had a lot of helpers.
You helped me a lot.
I did. Okay. Vaguely, when was this published?
We published the John Cage issue in 2005, but
five.
I began working on it in 2003.
So that may have been the thing that sparked our initial conversations.
Precisely.
Yeah. Because I remember one of the things, I don't have the book in front of me. I should have pulled it from the shelf this morning just for fun, that it's got, you have yours. Ta-da! what volume is that? Is it six?
It's number six.
Yeah, that's what I remembered.
Absolutely.
It's got some of the best coverage of Cage, Duchamp, and chess that's available in one place. You did, I remember, Sean Bronzel.
Absolutely.
Did a piece for you for that. I think you did that with him, did you not?
I did. Yes. Yeah. And I also wrote a piece about John Cage's artworks, many of which include issues of chess and other themes that overlap with the work of Duchamp. And I had indispensable help from David Vaughan at the Cunningham Dance Archives. He was an essential resource because he had a memory like a steel trap.
Exactly. And what he didn't remember, he had little tiny cards that he could look up.
Yes, he did. And you kindly opened up the door to Merce, and I had the privilege of being able to interview him about Duchamp, which was invaluable because Merce was not a person who spoke with any frequency. But he was willing to talk to me about Duchamp, and specifically about his dance Walk Around Time, which is sort of homage to Duchamp, and was the place where Duchamp appeared publicly for the last time at the premiere in Buffalo, New York.
That's exactly right. I have that picture of him and what's his name? Visual artist.
Richard Hamilton.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I always remember that picture of, I think it's you and me, isn't it? That there was a photograph of, I can't remember, but I think it's you and me in this picture. And it was sitting on, somebody said, I heard this through the grapevine. Somebody said, who's that woman in that picture? And they said, oh, that's Paul Franklin's wife.
Nope, that would not be right.
Exactly. And I think it was Trevor who told me this, Trevor Carlson, who I've done a show on, All Things Cage, a two-parter actually. But Trevor was there and he said, that is definitely not Paul Franklin's wife.
That's funny.
It was adorable. Anyway, I vividly remember you coming to dinner on a number of occasions, Paul, at Merce's
apartment.
This may have been in tandem with your doing interviews with Merce. Do you think that's possible?
Of course. That's what it was. I had my little tape recorder You very kindly and very discreetly prepared dinner for us. And I asked Merce if I could turn the machine on. He said yes. And off we went.
I see. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still have those recordings. And occasionally I actually listen to his voice.
Yeah. He loved intelligence, so it's not that he was quiet or didn't really want to talk much. It's that he didn't want to talk to you unless you were intelligent, that if you had questions that made sense to him or questions that were pressing in some way, he was quite willing to talk. But it was, it was the person who asked him the same silly question that critics had been asking him for 20 years.
Right.
That he just clammed up.
Sure. And my questions to Merce probably were in some way a bit of a breath of fresh air, because they were not specifically about what he always called the dance. But they were more personal questions about his relationship and friendship with this very important figure in his life and in John's life and in the life of many of his friends.
Right. No, there's no question.
One of the things I particularly remember about Merce was the very unique way that he constructed sentences. He did not have a strictly Cartesian way of answering a question. And it sort of reminds me of the way a body moves when it's dancing. There are parts that he would interject into the response, and they wouldn't come together until the end of the sentence. And I remember sitting at dinner with you being completely wowed by this man's very unique way of thinking. 'Cause I'm an academically trained scholar, I'm from the Midwest, you know, so many things about me are traditionally formed. And Merce was a fascinating case study and somebody who clearly was way beyond my league as a creative mind. And that creative mind came out of his mouth in such an apparent way that it was enchanting for me.
Yeah. He was always afraid that people weren't interested in what he had to say in social settings. I remember after John died, he made some very forlorn statement that nobody will want to come over now, because John is incredible. Not here, you know.
Incredible.
And to which I said, that's really incredible, and it's so not true. Let's not go there.
Not at all. Uh-huh.
But it is true that he thought, I don't even know what to call it. I was going to say that he thought kinesthetically.
Exactly. That's
and
basically
I think
what
that's
I was
kind of
say.
What you're saying, isn't it? You know, that, mm-hmm. you know, it's...
Absolutely. His reference, I think, for his foundation and his reference for everything was the dance. So it's no surprise that words fit in a sort of dance context for him when he employed them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I found that very, very beautiful and incredibly memorable, because I've never encountered someone like that.
Interesting. His diaries are also not the way you're describing them. I was kind of running them in my head as you were talking. But what they are is intentionally florid, the way he wrote. So they were the very, very careful use of adjectives, almost poetic use of adjectives, you know, as if he knew that someone else was going to be reading this someday, and he wanted to be remembered as the person who wrote this way. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's not artificial, because he did have a surprising mind, as you know. But to have him express it in kind of everyday language, like, for example, this is actually in David Vaughan's book, where David Vaughan was interviewing him about one of the venues.
Mm-hmm.
David Vaughan said something. Yes, well, do you remember that stage, that very small stage in that theater? And Merce interrupted him and said, well, I wouldn't call it a stage, David. It was more like a shelf.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
It is brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's go back to our dear friend Monique, as Monique likes to tell me, she is the oldest person she knows.
Yes, so Monique just celebrated her 96th birthday.
Exactly, last Tuesday.
Last Tuesday.
Paul came into New York to be with Monique, which is incredibly sweet. How long have you been friends, you and Monique?
Monique and I have known each other since 1997. We're getting up there in years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Monique met Duchamp in France in 1951.
Wow.
She met Duchamp in New York in 1951, after having sought out his older brother to get Duchamp's address in America. Because she came to America on the Marshall Plan as an interpreter, and met him quickly after her arrival in New York in 1951, and they stayed friends until he passed away in 1968.
Isn't that amazing? It's just amazing.
Absolutely.
She is, for our listeners, Monique is even more than a friend to me. She's been an incredible helper, in the sense that whenever I've done any publication of anything for any reason of Cage or Cunningham, but it's primarily Cage, she's been my go-to person for giving me translations. Ostensibly, I would write to her and I would say, Cage wrote this, can you translate this for me? And mm-hmm. she would write me back and she would say, Laura dear, would you like me to fix his French? And I'd say, well, maybe not, but is it really bad? And she'd say, well, he means this here, not that. And he means this over here, not that.
Monique's a very talented translator.
She's amazing, amazing.
She translated Silence into French in 1970. She also translated Octavio Paz into
right.
in French. And when Octavio Paz wrote his first text on Duchamp in Spanish, Monique, who also knows Spanish, she translated it for Duchamp.
Isn't that amazing? Amazing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So she's a very important and very discreet bridge between so many of us who work in the Duchamp and Cage worlds in France and America.
Yeah, yeah. You were, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were living in Paris by the time we met.
Yes, I was.
And you were working for the Fondation, were you not?
I was. I was working with Jackie Matisse Monnier, helping her run the Duchamp estate. And I continued doing that until 2016, when I stopped publishing Étendonné.
How many issues of Étendonné did you do in total?
We did 11 issues and a total of over 2,500 pages.
Wow.
So every issue was basically like a book, as you know, your usage of the term book to describe Étendonné is totally correct.
Oh no, it's beyond a book. It's more than a book. It's like books. It's like several books.
Several books.
Yeah. So was Monique as close to Jackie as she was to you?
Monique was she was close to Jackie. And she was also very close to a mutual friend of Jackie's named Denise Brown Hare.
Oh, I know Denise. I knew who she, I didn't know her personally, but she was later in life, she became a very interesting macrobiotic chef.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I remember Cage hired her. I don't know on what terms, but he hired her to come and do the whole menu and the cooking and all of it for very old friend of his. God, I'm blocking her name. This is so terrible. She was the editor of Modern Music.
Don't know.
Minna Daniel.
Minna Daniel.
Yes. And it was Minna's 90th birthday. Ah. And Cage was throwing a party and he hired Denise Hare to come and do all of the cooking.
That doesn't surprise me. Denise Brown Hare had been married to David Hare, the surrealist American artist. Uh-huh. And that's how Denise knew Duchamp, and she and Monique both lived in the village and they became very, very close friends. And Jackie was very close to Denise Brown Hare as well.
Right. I think I knew that much about Jackie and Denise. Mm-hmm. And then Monique is very close to Jackie's daughter, right?
Absolutely. Cathy Shen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who lives in the Upper West Side or something, right?
She splits her time between New York and upstate now.
Uh-huh. Where upstate? Anywhere near us?
Somewhere near you. Yes. Uh-huh.
I should drop her a note. I have her email address and everything. I wrote to her to thank her. She didn't have much choice in the matter.
Oh.
I told you that Merce left me a lot of his personal things.
Yes.
And one of the things that he left me in his personal things were all these scarves made by Kati.
Oh.
So I must have, I don't know how many, 4 or 5 of these beautiful multicolored scarves, these, you know. Of course. I wrote to Kati and thanked her.
Oh, that's sweet. She's known for her scarves.
Yeah. They're beautiful. Merce used to wear them all the time. So it was like a little piece of him and a little piece of Kati at the same time.
Right, right. What's so beautiful is the way that the succeeding generations maintain a sort of friendship that endures.
Yeah.
From Duchamp's relationship to Merce and John's relationship with Duchamp, it goes to Jackie and it transfers to Kati. And I mean, there's this one big family.
Exactly, exactly. And even if you don't know each other, you know who the other one is.
Precisely. It's a small world, but it's a lovely world because it's small.
Yeah, yeah. Did Kati have children? I think she did, right?
He has three sons.
Three. I think I vaguely remember the birth of the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't it whose son was it that went to Bard? That came to Bard and studied.
It was one of Kati's sons.
It was Kati. It wasn't, God, what's the son's name? What's her uncle's name?
Her uncle's name. You mean Jackie's brothers?
Yes.
Paul Matisse and Peter.
Who is Antoine?
Antoine's her brother.
Her brother. That's Jackie. That's Kati's brother?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Somehow I always thought he was much older than she was.
No.
Oh, that's so funny.
Kati's older than Antoine.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it was Antoine's son who came to Bard.
Right. Victor.
Yes, Victor. Thank you very much. My memory is not what it used to be.
I don't know.
But this was a good decade ago. So he either did come to Bard, graduated and left, or didn't come to Bard. And I never.
Oh, so he did him. Come to Bard. He came to Bard for a time.
He did.
Yes.
He would not. Our paths never crossed. I never met him. Mm-hmm. Antoine, though, came to talk with me when he was bringing Victor there, when he was coming and doing the research for Victor.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Anyway. So you now, you're not, the Fondation is not still functioning, or it is, who's at the head of it?
Antoine.
Antoine still is. He's been the head of it for a long time now, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you are not affiliated with the Fondation at all?
Not anymore. No.
Since you stopped doing the journal.
Precisely. The book. So now I basically am an independent scholar, and I have been focusing more of my attention on curatorial work. So I've been curating in the last couple of years, which is a new activity for me, but one that was a sort of natural segue from being the editor-in-chief of Etant Donnée, because what I was basically doing in two dimensions on a page, I am now doing in three dimensions in art galleries and art museums.
Yeah, yeah. It's great fun, isn't it?
It's incredibly, incredibly rewarding.
Yes, I've only done one real museum show that I curated top to bottom. And really, it was the most fun I'd had in years to do that, because it was like gathering ideas and materials and objects into a book. It was like that, except it was easier, you know, because this goes there and that goes like that. And you could just move things around and look at it. And I don't know, it was easier than using a word.
Absolutely. And the beautiful about curatorial work is that you can tell many different stories with the same artworks. So the story you decide to tell ultimately depends on how you place various artworks in dialogue with one another.
Of course, yes.
And certain things that you think speak to each other instantly, when you actually are in the process of hanging them, you realize that they don't speak to each other at all, and they have to find new places. And things that you were sure had nothing to say to one another become intimately linked. And you realize on the spot, how could I have missed that? So the process of curating is this process that actually has really no start or end to it. It's incredibly Duchampian in that way.
Yeah, yeah. It's also Cagean, because
it's totally Cagean.
Chance operations, you're talking about the greatest perk of chance operations is that you use chance and find out something new about the materials you're working with, you know.
And you find out things that are new, because of course you allow your prejudices to step aside. And that's the real beauty of it. And in fact, you see the power of the object in and of itself, and the way that it actually sort of communicates by its own means to other things that are in the show.
No, I totally get that. But I just, my main feeling about curating is how much fun it is.
I agree. Absolutely.
It's more joyful. The process of it is more joyful than, say, writing a book, because writing a book is sloggy. It's hard. Sometimes it's really thick.
There are all of the sort of pre-installation parts of an exhibition can be methodical, disappointing, complicated, because you have to secure loans from individuals and institutions, some of which say yes, some of which say no, and certain never reply.
Right. Do you have access? So now you're not affiliated with the Fundación. You're personally affiliated, but you're not professionally affiliated.
Correct.
Do you have access to the materials and to the holdings of the Fundación?
Yes, absolutely. I'm on very good terms, and you know, the estate is very, very supportive and willing to lend things to the projects that I am working on. So
perfect. It's so good to hear, because you are one of their greatest assets.
Oh, thank you.
You are. You know those materials probably better than anybody, and there you are, now carving your way into a place in the world in which you use those materials for the greater good, you know?
So right. Because the real desire I have is to share the knowledge that I have acquired with other people. That's one of the joys that I have in my life, and one of the needs I have. I don't need to possess things. I'm not a collector, for instance.
Right. Me too.
I love meeting people, and I now realize, being middle-aged, that the people I have had the privilege of meeting, people now come to me to ask what it was like to know them. So I become this sort of link in a chain, which I never envisioned when I was younger. But it's a pleasure to be able to share these, you know, sometimes very incidental anecdotes about having known people and spent time with them. So
absolutely. And you know, sometimes those anecdotes are more revealing than hard facts.
Precisely. I'll tell you a story about Monique,
please,
which is one of my favorite stories to tell to other people. So Monique meets Marcel Duchamp in New York in 1951. There's a 40-year age span between them. Monique is 24 and Duchamp is 64. 2 years later, Duchamp offers to give Monique a tour of the Museum of Modern Art. Who would not want a tour of the Museum of Modern Art by Marcel Duchamp? She accepts. They go into the galleries, and they arrive in the galleries where Marcel Duchamp's work is displayed. And Monique very courageously looks at Duchamp and says, "Mr. Duchamp," because she never called him Marcel, "Mr. Duchamp, I have to admit that I don't understand your work." Duchamp looks at her, smiles, and says, "Monique, no problem. Don't worry about it. The important thing is that we're friends." And Monique, at 96, has never forgotten that story and continues to tell it.
Beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Because, of course, the priority for Duchamp was not proving that he was an intelligent individual, not talking about his artwork, something he constantly refused to do. What was important was human contact. And Cage had that same relationship with Duchamp. You know, Cage, at the end of his life, he says this incredibly profound thing. He says, "I cannot get along without Duchamp. Duchamp allowed us to live as we do." It's not just the fact that Duchamp was an artist that was so important to Cage. It was the fact that Duchamp offered a model for getting through the universe that appealed to people like John Cage and Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that Cage assumed that role after Marcel?
Absolutely.
You know, it's so interesting. He became the person, the permission giver, the the, you know, for like it or not, you know, there were some people that were irritated by Cage's authority, which just seemed to assume he just had it. You know, it wasn't like he was trying to be something.
Precisely. Duchamp had that very same authority decades before Cage. And it's probably not an accident that Cage was able to comfortably assume that authority because he had seen Duchamp 30, 40, 50 years earlier doing exactly the same thing.
Right, right. I think that's true. I always, not always, but I also chalk it up a little bit to Cage's relationship with his father, or his parents in general, maybe both of them, but more so his father. You know, his father would say, there are many famous little quotes, you know, Cage's father told him once that he, John, his son, was his best invention. They were very, very in support of their son. You know, they thought that whatever he wanted to do, he could do. It was just a very trusting, very, very supportive relationship. So Cage believed in himself in a kind of unquestioned way, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there's also a kind of modesty that Cage had that is similar to the kind of modesty and understated manner that Duchamp got through the universe. And, you know, Cage is the first American who is so taken by Duchamp and influenced by Duchamp. But he's also the first artist to be influenced by Duchamp without copying Duchamp. Which is the problem of a lot of contemporary artists today. They say that Duchamp is their model and their inspiration, but they can't get beyond Duchamp himself. Whereas Cage instantly saw that the door that Duchamp opened offered a range of possibilities that he was eager to embrace, and possibilities which became Cage's own.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You must know this book. I'm just curious if you like it as much as I do. The book is called Why Duchamp.
Of course.
Yes. Absolutely. Do you like this book? I mean, it's one of my favorite books on Duchamp. It just, I would love to have written that book.
The book by Gianfranco Barrichello.
Exactly, Barrichello.
who is still alive and 98 years old.
How old?
98.
98. So you tell Monique for me. Laura said to tell Monique that Barrichello is 98.
Absolutely. That is a beautiful, beautiful.
I love that book so much.
And Monique tried for years and years and years to get a French publishing house to pay for a French translation, and no one was interested.
Oh my God, it's so crazy. That book is so beautiful.
I agree. I
you
did
just
an issue.
Want to revisit it again. Just talking about it makes me want to read it again. You know, I just love his writing, and I love the way that he presents Duchamp in that book.
He makes Duchamp accessible because he writes about Duchamp as a friend and as a person.
Yeah.
And that's that's what's so memorable.
Yeah.
I did an issue of Etant Donné devoted to Barrichello.
Oh my God, I need it. Which one is it? Do you remember?
Number 10.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it over here.
I'll send it to you, Laura.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I would love it. He also did, wasn't it Barrichello who also did things about agroforestry and agriculture?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I read another one of his books. It was on the subject of art and...
Art and
or something. It was fascinating.
He was interested in sustainability. He was interested in, you know, bringing farming into the urban landscape decades before.
Exactly. Because I remember when I read that book, and this would have been, I don't even know, way back, 80s, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where I read the Barrichello Duchamp book, but then I found this other one, which was the same format, the same publisher.
Exactly.
Right? It was a smallish book. And I remember reading this and thinking, what a weird book. You know, like How did anybody publish this book? Who
Exactly.
wanted this book except me? I mean, I loved it, but it was like I couldn't imagine that it had more than 10 people that would read it at the time.
At the time, and now it's unbelievably pertinent. You know, Barrichello is another sort of character who had a relationship with Duchamp that was very much a sort of father-son relationship.
He's still living in Italy, I assume.
He's still living in Rome. Absolutely.
And is he well, do you know? I mean, is he lucid? Is he, does he?
He seems to be. So, yeah, I mean, he and Calvin Tompkins are the two oldest, you know, Duchamp eyewitnesses.
Right. Well, we certainly have had some interesting friends.
We sure have. Absolutely. Tell me about some of your, I'm now going to interrogate you, Laura, because.
Okay,
you
know, what do you want to know? What do you want to know?
When did you first meet Cage?
I met Cage. I was at graduate school at UCLA. My first meeting with Cage had nothing to do with this. It was prior to that. I was in graduate school at UCLA, and Cage was a visiting artist along with many others, Morty Feldman, Takemitsu. There were a handful of composers who came to an event at CalArts, California Institute for the Arts in Valencia. Just very close. We at UCLA used to refer to CalArts as the sandbox up the hill. Because that was where all the creative kids went, as opposed to us. We scholars, we were down, you know, hunkered down at UCLA, closer to the Getty. Anyway, but he had, he was giving a concert at CalArts during this kind of residency with these other people. It was a performance of his piece called Lecture on the Weather, which was a piece for speakers who either play instruments or don't. They do it, they make their own programs with Thoreau quotations. This is a very beautiful work. And I had never seen it or heard it live. I just had read about it. And I went up to CalArts to attend this cocktail party, which I did, and then attend this concert. But I got stuck in traffic. Perfect LA story. I mean, the traffic was so awful that by the time I got, I was like 40 minutes late for it. So I thought I'll just go straight to the concert. But I get there and I walk into Disney Hall at CalArts, into the foyer. And I said, oh, thank goodness they haven't even started yet. Except that was the piece. So all of the players were on soapboxes and they were all mic'd and they were all performing. And I felt like a complete idiot. And then I met John at the cocktail party and I was able to tell him this, that, you know, I'm such a dolt. I thought it was the piece hadn't even started, that everybody was just waiting in the foyer.
Wonderful.
Oops.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oops. But you had a sufficient amount of courage and assuredness to admit that to him.
Totally. I think that we shared certain things. And one of the things we shared was that kind of that bravado or that belief in the humanity of people, you know, that I firmly believed that and continue to believe that. So, you know, from the get-go, he was a confidant. You know, he would walk in the room if I was talking to somebody quietly, he'd say, no, don't mind me, talk louder. You know?
Oh, that's great. And you quickly met Merce after that? Or
No. So that was, I want to say it was the following year, I got a grant to go to New York to study so-called intermedia art. So art forms, now everything's intermedia. So we don't actually think of it. But back then, it was anytime you stuck a visual artist with a composer or a choreographer with a visual artist or whatever, filmmaker with a musician, that was inter art, you know. So I was sent to New York to study for, I think it was a 6-month grant.
I see.
I went there. And oddly, Merce Cunningham and John Cage were not on my list of people to study, which is very funny. You know,
interesting.
It is interesting, actually. I can't explain it and I don't try to, but It was during that trip that I ran out of stuff to do. I had done a lot of work at the Brooklyn Academy. I had worked a little bit with Robert Wilson, Meredith Monk, Ping Chong. And I was kind of done. I was looking for something to do. And it was my mentor, the person who was kind of the mother hen, if you will, of that granting program, who was emeritus, UCLA, had moved to Julia and moved to New York and was now teaching at Juilliard and had a long history with Cage, long relationship. And it was her that called me and said, "Excuse me, but I'm going to mimic her Austrian accent. Laura, what do we do now? You're all done with your work. What are you going to do?" I said, "Mia, I don't know. What do you think I should do? I have about 6 weeks." And she said, "Well, you could help John Cage. Would you be willing to do that?" And I said, "Are you serious?" "Yeah." Anyway, she set me up with Cage to help him. Yeah. And it was also the conniving of Betty Freeman. Do you remember Betty Freeman?
Sure,
You must
absolutely.
have known her.
I didn't.
You
No,
didn't know her, but you knew who she
no,
was.
of course.
Betty Freeman was, I did one show on her actually. Betty Freeman was a photographer and a pianist, but mostly she was known as a benefactor to contemporary artists, many of whom we all know and love from
Absolutely.
that period. But anyway, Betty Freeman and Pia used to fight over who introduced me to John Cage first. And so
Very
if I
flattering,
was,
Laura.
that's right.
Very
So when
flattering.
I was with Betty, I would always say it was Betty. And when I was in with Pia, I would always say, "Pia, of course, it was Pia."
Utterly diplomatic.
And they were born, I think, one day apart, and they had this little rivalry, not just around me, all kinds of things. Pia used to say, "Well, I never had my face lifted."
Oh, incredible.
Yeah.
That's
Anyway,
incredible. Oh.
but so I met John during that trip. So Pia really kind of pushed us together, and really, it was love at first sight. It was really, we got, I, for whatever reason, I have no qualms about being around famous people. You know, I don't treat them any differently. I might be a fan of their work or them, but I'm not scared of them. I'm not stymied by them. I'm not, you know what I mean? So,
Right.
yeah.
You see a
So,
difference. You see a difference between the work and the individual.
yeah. And I just fell in love
And
with him. He was so, you know, the work was wonderful, but he was his best work, you know. He
there
was so lovely, and so he was such a mensch,
you go.
so caring. And it wasn't until I started really working with him that I fell in love as much with his work.
Oh,
Then
that's
all,
beautiful.
yeah, it was knowing him that actually opened up the work for me even further. And he, I could, in some respects, do no wrong with him. So it didn't matter anything that I said or felt or thought and shared with him, he respected it. He respected it.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
That's
no, it was a beautiful relationship. He used to say, "Where have you been all my life?"
oh.
I'd say, "Where have you been all mine?" It was
Right.
like coming home when I met him. It was really very much like coming home. And I was very, very close to my mother, but John was he was something else, something different.
Yeah, no,
Anyway,
I
and Merce was very standoffish with anybody who John brought into the house. So he, it was like, this is his home, and we had to be gone. We helpers had to be gone by the time he got there. I could not go to work with John until after Merce had left for the studio. And it was really John who, toward the end of his life, I'm not going to say he was had a premonition of the end of his life coming, but I think he did on some level. And he started to put Merce, me and Merce together. He would kind of pour champagne for us at a table. He would, you know, he would say, "Merce, tell Laura about that new computer software program you're using." Or he would nurture a relationship between us, which I want to say, in during the time that that was going on wasn't terribly meaningful, but it was really helpful after John died.
Absolutely.
Because Merce was not left alone. You know, that he and I had forged a relationship in spite of his not really wanting to, mm-hmm. with somebody that was helping. You know, he was a little jealous of John. He was a little jealous that John had all these helpers. I said, Merce, you have IBM down at Westport. You know, there's like 35 employees all just holding their breath, waiting to help you. You know,
right. But there's something about that. There's something about that very, very personal connection that you had with John Cage that probably created a certain kind of longing for Merce.
Yes, I believe that that's true. And he and I developed that very quickly.
Because John sowed the seeds for that.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And Merce, we grew to really love each other and to appreciate each other, even though for me, Merce couldn't have been more different than John. I mean, he was, you know, John, mm-hmm. John was, well, to say it in the reverse, Merce was so insecure. Mm-hmm. He was just insecure. And John didn't have an insecure bone in his body, or he never thought about it. He never, you know, he just did what he did. He would never worry about whether or not he had done the right thing or whether or not people would like it or, you know.
Right. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, begin anywhere. That's
yes, yeah. The one of the most meaningful things he ever said to me was, we were talking about, I was talking about some review in the newspaper, in the New York Times, about some concert of his works, of John's works. And I said, did you read, I don't remember who it was, John Rockwell, maybe, whoever mm-hmm. it was. I said, did you read the Times piece on your concert the other night? And he said, oh, no. And I said, I don't understand that about you. Why don't you read the reviews? You know, why wouldn't you want to know what people who listen to music all the time have to say about? Mm. And he said, I said, do you not want to be criticized? He said, oh, Laura, that's not it at all. And I said, well, tell me then. And he said, it's that they're quick to criticize my answers, but they never question me about my questions. And I thought it was so brilliant. That was so brilliant. And it was so true. Nobody ever said, you know, okay, I get your chance operations, but why limit it to this? Or why did you have only these instruments? Or why did you, you know, nobody cared about that. They were always ready to talk about the answers that Cage got, where for Cage, the answers weren't nearly as important as the questions he was asking, ever, you know.
Interesting. Duchamp said something like that. Something very similar to that in an interview in 1945, he was asked a question about, you know, something that seemed to be unsolvable. And he said, there is no solution because there is no problem. But it's this sort of recognition that you don't have to dramatize it. It doesn't have to be this life-shattering experience. You can actually get through the world by maintaining a sort of healthy balance between courage and naivete, and it
right,
can work.
Right, right. No, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
We have to stop if we're going to save some time for some music.
I don't mind saving time for music, Laura.
Okay. I'm sorry to let you go, though. I haven't seen you in so long. So, you know, I think we just have to every now and then have a Zoom date or something.
I agree.
Okay, good. And you can tell me what's going on. And we didn't talk about your show. We didn't talk about your, I'll make reference to it at least, to your new curatorial project in your intro about being at the Guggenheim, which I might come to. You never
know. I know.
It would be thrilling for me to see your latest
work. It would be a pleasure to show you.
Okay. Well,
and Peggy Guggenheim, who's responsible for Cage and Duchamp meeting each other.
Oh, I know. There's so many. Oh, my God.
How many layers?
All these things that we haven't talked about. All these things.
We'll do another one.
All right. No, I'm serious. I think we're going to.
We'll focus it more on a specific thematic.
Okay. All right. Maybe maybe your curatorial work and the work and the project coming up for Peggy, which would lead us to Peggy and lead us to what you're going to do for that. Are you far enough along with that?
I am. Yeah, my checklist is nearly complete, so things are moving along quite well.
My God, let's do another show. I'm serious. Let's do another
Okay.
show.
All
We'll
right.
do Laura and Paul Goat Rodeo
Laura,
part
Paul, and
two.
Peggy.
Yes, Laura, Paul, and Peggy. Yes, Peggy Guggenheim is a good talk. You know,
Yeah, I think so. I think
she's an
so.
interesting person.
Yeah, she really is. And another really central character for both Cage and Duchamp in the early and the middle years for both
Yes.
of them.
All right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right,
Thank you
Laura.
so much. I'll be in touch with you, kiddo. I promise.
Okay, and send me your address so I can send you the Barrichello Duchamp issue,
I
okay?
will, and I'll send you a copy of Love Icebox.
Let me give you the address in the south of France, which you do not have, because that's where I'm mostly based now. Okay?
Perfect. Can you,
All
you'll
right.
email it to me?
I'll email it to you, Laura, in 2 minutes.
Okay, and when I see that, I'll email you back.
Perfect. It's a
It
deal. Well,
was
as ever, it's a joy to talk to you.
as always, we didn't talk about the fact that you're one of 27 children, but
No, but that'll come up at another point.
exactly. Okay, take care of yourself.
All
I'll be
right,
in touch.
Laura, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now let's listen to Margaret Ling Tan play John Cage's music for Marcel Duchamp, courtesy of Mode Records. That is Mode 106, John Cage, Volume 25 from 2002. Enjoy.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.